feet, not inches. That's our snow stat. Isn't it pretty? I'm done saying that. It couldn't keep coming relentlessly, could it? I've simply exhausted places to put it. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody, coming to you from the heart of Western Wisconsin, geographically and artistically. This is where the people and places come to talk about the arts, music, and culture of where we live. I'm honored to bring it all your way. This week, Eric Lee, the Eau Claire artist, after a painful hiatus, received some great news. We're going to share it all with you. Given our current pronounced season, we're happy to use the word spring, as in Spring Valley, Jim Oliver and guest preview a play with a young cast. One of UWEC political scientist Eric Casper's books is about the U.S. Constitution as portrayed in motion pictures. We'll get to that this week. And to initiate this expedition, Memorial High School students in Eau Claire are tackling a tough subject and a tough assignment. The subject is human trafficking, and the assignment has been to write, produce, and present a play about it. Part of the assignment is complete. What's left is to welcome audiences to the Riverside Theater and the Haas Fine Arts Center next weekend. Three young ladies involved in the process, Kerrigan Hollenbeck, Josie Butzler, and Emily Ruth, skipped school to join me in the studio. They had permission. I'm going to think back to my high school days, which isn't easy, because that's a long way away. Our thespian troupe, and I wasn't in it, but I remember the plays they put on. They simply did other people's plays, usually classics. We had social issues back then. We had war. We had free love. We had the British invasion. We had miniskirts to deal with. But no one asked the theater people to come up with their own play. So I'm wondering if this is just a theatrical project, or is it tied to some other classes, like any kind of social studies? Who's going?
My name's Emily Ruth. I don't mean to volunteer you, Kerrigan, but you've been in the class the longest because mm-hmm. this is a class you can take multiple times.
Yes.
And the class is?
Documentary theater from Memorial High School. Mm-hmm. The purpose of the class is so varied from semester to semester because we create our own projects. Kerrigan, if you'd like to read off our class statement.
Yes, do that.
Okay, my name is Kerrigan Hollenbeck. Our class is focused on combining arts and social justice because it creates a story that people can connect to and feel for and be moved by, because in our current day-to-day, we're bombarded by so many different stories in the news about awful things that are going on around us. So it can be kind of hard to connect to what's going on. Mm-hmm. But when you get the arts involved, there's empathy. You're confronted with it in your face, and it's not easy to ignore.
What other topics have you tackled?
Traffic, our production right now. It's a play about human trafficking. Uh-huh. That's our biggest project and the one we've been working on for the longest. You guys started working on it second semester of last year?
No. The first interview we had with Fierce Freedom, which is mm-hmm. how we started growing our interest yep. in it, was in September of last year. Last yes. full school year, not this school year.
Okay.
So it's been over a year in production.
But the class itself, documentary theater, is this a brand new class?
It's fairly new. I believe this is, I'm Josie Butzler, by the way.
Yeah.
This is our third semester of having the class available to us.
Oh,
so
okay.
this is kind of our first major project. We've worked on some other things in the past, but this is definitely the biggest thing that we have tried to tackle so far.
So was this a directive? Were you told what to do as far as a subject, or is
no.
this something you were challenged to come up with? What happened?
Our class is something called a makerspace, where it's not teacher-led, like a teacher is there to kind of guide us and give us resources.
Mm-hmm.
The students are meant to come up with the curriculum. I guess Kerrigan can speak to this
yeah.
because she was mm-hmm. there when the whole traffic idea was conceived.
Yeah, you guys keep passing it off to Kerrigan.
She's been here the longest.
Okay. That's what happens with seniority.
Technically, Josie and I are the seniors
yep.
here, only in age.
Sure.
Yeah, last year when we were just starting, we spent probably a month or two just kind of brainstorming all the different things that we wanted. We would spend days, probably a few weeks in mm-hmm. class, just coming up with all of our ideas and what we wanted to talk about. Because this is a class that we're using arts for social justice, there's so much going on and there's so much that we were talking about. just a lot of different ideas and different ways that we wanted to approach different things. Mm-hmm. And so there were just so many ideas. We got kind of lost in them. And so we started having some guest speakers come in. And my grandpa, Dave Malone, is actually the vice president on the board at Fierce Freedom. Hey, we can have my grandpa come in and give us a discussion on this. And so as soon as he came in, the rest of our class was just kind of hooked on this topic because it's so prevalent in Eau Claire, but not a lot of people are as aware of it because it's kind of one of those things where, oh, this is happening in a bunch of third world countries that I don't have to worry about, but it's actually right here in our town. And so we just kind of hooked onto it and it grew from there.
I was going to say that in motion pictures, of course, the credits that roll at the end usually have what's called a technical advisor, the Fierce Freedom people, or is there one person who is acting kind of more along the lines of technical advisor for this play that you came up with? To keep it real, to keep everything the way it actually happens.
We've had special guest speakers come into the class and review the script. Guest speakers, I guess, isn't the right term, just guests in general.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we've invited members from the community, members involved with theater, members involved with human trafficking, because we want to be able to tell an authentic story and we want to be able to tell it well. And by that, I mean put on a good performance that really does justice to the subject matter.
I'm in the studio with Kerrigan Hollenbeck, Josie Butzler, and Emily Ruth. They are Eau Claire Memorial High School students. They're putting on a play. It's called Traffic. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, March 1st through 3rd, Riverside Theater, Haas Fine Arts Center, UW Eau Claire. You have kind of a melting pot of cast and crew, right? You have people from other places. Tell me about it.
Yes. Primarily, our actors are Memorial High School students, but we have some students from North High School. Emily's little sister is actually in it, so we have someone from South Middle School, and then we also have a CVTC student.
So how did they get involved?
Well, we used social media to our advantage to advertise auditions. Also just word of mouth, you know, talking to any friends who might be interested. Because when we were first talking about casting for the show, once we'd finished writing, we wanted to make sure that this was open to as many people as possible so that we could really do a good job with telling the story. Another reason that it is at the Riverside Theater is because if we were to put it on at Memorial, we would have had to censor a lot of the script. Because it's so hard to tell, you know, tell a story about something as visceral as human trafficking without touching on subjects like underage drinking. I mean, sexual assault, you know, so many other topics that you really aren't allowed to talk about in a school setting.
Does the language get a little rough or not?
There is like some cussing thrown in at certain high points, but I wouldn't say it's very prevalent throughout the script.
It's not gratuitous swearing, no.
No.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of a theater thing where you try to avoid it unless it's 100% necessary or a character trait, and none of our characters really have that as one of their big traits. So if it's thrown in, it's only when it's absolutely necessary to get the emotion across.
Okay. So now that we've tossed out a whole bunch of hors d'oeuvres about the story, give us what you can about the story you've created without ruining it for us. It's the story of a young lady and a young guy, yes?
Correct. It's the story of a young woman. The girl's name is Sam Reed, and she meets a boy by the name of Jake who goes to her school. It's sort of a story of the grooming process and how easily it is for someone to get sucked into the process of trafficking because Jake seems like just a normal high schooler, but he does have connections to a human trafficking ring. And it just shows how easily a really wonderful relationship can start into a grooming process and how easy it is for those around you to really turn into being the problem with that. And another big point that we really want to touch on in our story is recovery and growth. And we have throughout the story several therapy scenes. Most of the play is set in the present, but we do have some points where we look forward and we see Sam with a therapist. And we really want to emphasize growth and that you can come back from something like this. You are not helpless.
The documentary theater class did all the research to put this on and write it.
Correct.
But when you're on stage as an actor and you're trying to portray this dilemma, you have to feel it. So how are the actors being made to feel it? Were they able to talk to the people that you researched with? Were they able to meet with Fierce Freedom people? And, you know, there's method acting. You know, you got to get into the deal.
Yeah. We haven't had Fierce Freedom come into a rehearsal, but they have PowerPoints and all sorts of online resources. So we've given all of our actors a debriefing and kind of a human trafficking 101 course that we've led. And so we've been telling them the biggest points and what they need to know, and then to get our actors as into it as possible. We've watched videos, online PSAs.
Mm-hmm. We've done character exercises. Mm-hmm. And to make it clear, there is some overlap with actors in the class. There are some people, members of the class, including Josie and myself, who are also in the show.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely been a very collaborative effort.
Well, you know, as I look at you guys involved in this at your young age, you know, I have to imagine that you are following this experience going to be a bit different. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all part of growing up and experiencing the real world. You'll be a little bit different after than you were before. Do you feel that?
Oh, yeah. I think it's definitely been a nice maturing process. We've definitely grown through this. We've learned how to advocate. We've learned how to collaborate. We've learned how to reach out to others in our community and ask for assistance. And I think it's just really been a positive experience for everyone involved, I would say.
Yeah. Especially,
go ahead.
Especially because this issue hits so close to home. It's one of those things where once you hear about it and once you hear that it's happening to the people around you, it's happening at those motels that you drive by when you're getting your gas, it's integrated into our community. And so it's one of those things where once you hear that, you can't really forget about it. And every time you drive past one of those motels, you think, I hope that everyone there is there on their own will. And you can't quite forget it.
Yeah. And I mean, going into this project, I had no idea that the, you know, target age range for people who are trafficked is so close to my and my peers' age. You know, the age range for boys is 10 to 12, and for girls it's 12 to 14. And
yikes.
I mean, yikes is really how you respond. I mean, as Josie mentioned, my younger sister is in this production. She's 12, you know? She's in that age range.
Wow. Mm.
And that, you know, really hits close to home for me.
Well, I need to congratulate you guys on accepting the challenge of doing this. And I'm curious as to whether you feel some post-production activism coming on. Mm. Do you feel like you might stay involved with this?
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the goal for this production is to contribute to activism. So not only are we hoping to educate those who come see the show, but also our proceeds are going to Fierce Freedom to help victims of human trafficking and to help educate. And we love everything that Fierce Freedom is about, and so we really want to help them out.
It's a good point. I wanted to make sure that that arose. Well, hey, you know, before I let you leave, Amber Dernbach's not here. What do you really think of her?
She's great. She's the one who facilitated this class being available at our school, so we're very thankful for that. She's been a really great resource because she has done this sort of writing thing in the past, and she has experience with activism within the community, and she has a lot of resources that we've been able to utilize. So we're very thankful to have her as an advisor.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's nice, but what do you really think?
Terrible person.
All three of us have done a lot of work with Amber in the past, and we feel very close to her.
Not only has she been a wonderful advisor, but she's also been respectful and faithful enough in us to give us the freedom that we have asked for. You know, this production, of course, Amber is a huge part of facilitating it and directing us and giving us guidance when we need it, but at the risk of sounding full of us as a group, you know, this is our show. We have put it on and worked on it. And Amber has been a huge part of that.
It takes a leap of faith because even though we're the ones who are putting it on, her name is still on that. And I just love that she trusts us enough and believes in us to the point where we can go and do this.
Good for you guys. Yeah. Hey, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. Oh, you said that together. It's called Traffic, 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, March 1st and 2nd, 1:30 p.m. Sunday, March 3rd, Riverside Theater, Haas Fine Arts Center, UW Eau Claire. Again, congratulations to everybody involved. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, an artist for a cause, with a cause, and just because. Coming up. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, dedicated to providing an enjoyable and stress-free buying process with welcoming facilities located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls or at MarquardtToyota.com. Support also comes from Literacy Chippewa Valley, host of the 2019 Scrabble Bee, April 18th at the Pablo Center in Eau Claire, accepting teams from businesses, organizations, and clubs for game night. LiteracyChippewaValley.org is that website. A couple weeks ago, Dr. Eric Casper, a UW-Eau Claire political science educator, visited to talk about a couple new original books. Timely, too. You Shook Me All Campaign Long, Music in the 2016 Presidential Campaign and Beyond. We covered that one, but I got so long-winded with curiosity that the clock ran out, and we had to shelve the second book for another time. Well, that time has arrived. The United States Constitution and Film, Part of Our National Culture, is book number two, and here's the continuation of our dialogue. How is the Constitution, and how has it been used in film, effectively?
Well, it's been done in a number of ways, and kind of a couple of different ways to think about this. One is a film using the Constitution or some sort of right or power mm-hmm. as a backdrop to then say something about that right or that power and the way that it is interpreted by the court or the way that it's in the Constitution.
An example of that is what?
A couple of examples you could look at. One would be a very famous film, Dirty Harry, came out in 1971. It was kind of a reaction to some of the Warren Court rulings expanding the rights of the accused. An interaction between Dirty Harry, portrayed by Clint Eastwood, and his nemesis, this guy who goes by the name of Scorpio, the serial killer, where Dirty Harry ends up bending and even breaking some rules in order to get this guy to confess, in order to get the evidence. Following that, there's this scene where the district attorney is basically chewing out Dirty Harry, saying, haven't you heard of the Miranda decision and what Miranda rights are? Haven't you heard of these other decisions saying that there are limits on what you can do as a police officer? And the film, in many ways, was trying to say that if you protect the rights of the accused too much, then that can be a very dangerous thing and that, criminals can go free.
Okay.
But you can contrast that with actually a film that came out earlier than that, 12 Angry Men, again, a very mm-hmm. famous film,
yep.
Where you have Henry Fonda playing one of these 12 jurors in a murder case. And initially, he is the only one to vote not guilty, and eventually he convinces all of them to vote mm-hmm. not guilty.
Yep.
But that is a film that, emphasizes the importance of making sure that the rights of the accused are protected, particularly the right to a jury trial, so that perhaps innocent people aren't imprisoned, or what the defendant in that case was going to face was the death penalty. And so you can kind of see both sides on that very same set of issues in terms of if you don't protect the rights of the accused enough, here are the downfalls. If you protect the rights of the accused too much, here are the problems. And both of those films are kind of in different directions trying to send a message to the viewer about how much we want to emphasize those rights and what the outcome of that can be.
Are they designed from the beginning to be political, or are they just entertainment?
No. I mean, all of these films are entertainment,
yeah.
But usually, there is some sort of message. The message can be more overt in some films than in others. The film The Post, I mean, it's a historical piece. It is about the Pentagon Papers case. The film is taking place in the early 1970s. The government has found out, because the newspapers are publishing part of these what are classified documents, the federal government is finding out and is taking these newspapers to courts,
yeah.
saying, look, this is a national security issue. They shouldn't be able to publish this. The newspapers are arguing, well, this is in the public interest, and this is really historical information that's in these documents, and so we have a First Amendment right to do this. And so it ultimately goes to the Supreme Court, where the court, in a divided decision, finds for the newspapers and says that they do have the right to publish it. That film is not just asking us to look back historically at the Vietnam War and during that era,
mm-hmm.
But also, from statements made by the director and other people involved with the film, it was very clear that they were making that film and they wanted to move forward at that time because they were trying to make a statement about the role of the press in the current era, and in particular, the relationship between the press and the White House, emphasizing the importance of the freedom of the press. And so even a film that might look like it's just about something that went on decades ago, the point of the film from the standpoint of the filmmaker or the producers or the actors or the writers could also be, we want to offer a certain take on contemporary politics.
Yeah,
and that
okay.
this basically they're trying to use this as a springboard into portraying that message to the public.
Is there an example of a film that literally turned public opinion?
Well, that is a harder thing to measure. In terms of what's being done, it's usually more subtle. And even if it is a little more overt, there usually isn't a lot of public opinion pollsters who would, you know, actually spend some time to ask questions. So it's a hard thing to measure. Some of these films that we could turn to that I think because they resonate well with us over time, and we can kind of look back historically and
oh, sure.
maybe judge it that way. I would say 12 Angry Men is certainly one of those films in terms of emphasizing the importance of the right to a jury trial. I think Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in terms of informing our perception about Congress and the powers of Congress and how a bill becomes a law. You know, it's a film that shows you all of the inner workings and, you know, all the sausage making, so to speak, and all the unseemly things. But it also has, you know, a happy ending, this concept that, that good can still be done. Congress can still use its powers to be effective. It's kind of a good film to make us feel good about what Congress does and what its powers are, which especially in the more modern films is typically not how Congress is portrayed. I mean, it's usually with only certain exceptions, it's usually viewed much more cynically. You can't necessarily be Mr. Smith in that particular film in the same way today because of how it's easier to end a filibuster in the Senate than it would have been at that time. But certainly that can be an inspiration for some of these senators in particular. And it may not mean that they're going to get the, you know, a particular bill passed or something like that, but it can be a very good way of calling national attention to a cause. You know, if you're a senator, you can't use that over and over again and expect the media to show up. But if you have something that's really important to you and this is your one time to be able to bring it up, that certainly can be an effective way to draw a lot more attention to it than otherwise might be the case.
Dr. Eric Casper with us, UW Eau Claire political scientist, the United States Constitution in film, part of our national culture, how the U.S. Constitution is portrayed in movies. Do you foresee more films? We need another Mr. Smith is what we need.
Well, that could be something that's helpful, although it had to be done right. People might still look at it differently in a modern audience.
Oh, sure.
Might say, well, that's unrealistic. Or
well,
something
they'd find
like
something wrong with Mr. Smith.
Right, probably.
They'd dig into his closet. Yeah.
Well, there's that issue, too. But, I mean, from a lot of different perspectives, whether it's, you know, the high number of films about the presidency that we see because, I mean, that's the most visible office in the entire government. So, you know, films about the powers of the presidency, I think we're going to see those for the foreseeable future. You know, First Amendment rights of the accused, because it gets into all the intrigue of a criminal case. So we're definitely going to continue to see that. But historical films, you look at in recent years, films like Lincoln or Selma.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And again, like The Post, I mean, they are rooted in a particular historical time, but they also have contemporary messages about things like equality under the Constitution, things like, and Lincoln, you know, what the goals and mm-hmm. the mission of the president should be and what those powers, how they should be viewed. And Lincoln also is a rare film in that it actually focuses on the constitutional amendment process and
oh, wow,
the passage
yeah.
of the 13th Amendment through Congress. Yeah, even those historical films, I think, yeah, depending on how they're done, but oftentimes they do have a message that they want to give us in terms of how we should think about the Constitution today, not just how we should think about when the Constitution was adopted or when an amendment was made to it.
Has there ever been a movie made? I know there probably has been a series on cable about the writing of the Constitution.
I don't
probably
know of
not,
any
huh?
film that's been, you know, as far as focus specifically on the Constitutional Convention.
We could have a dragged out rumble.
Right, you could. You know, we've certainly had films that have looked at particular framers and their lives.
Yeah.
We see that in terms of in other contexts. The theater and Hamilton is a big play right now. But focused on the actual Constitutional Convention, I don't know of any film that's done that. And, you know, maybe there's something there. Maybe we should be producers in Hollywood.
We should. The very fact that it has the word convention in it leads me to believe that there was hookers and a lot of booze. And that's what the word convention brings to mind.
Well, I don't think that the taverns in Philadelphia that summer were suffering from the fact that the convention delegates were there. Now, they did take their job very seriously at the convention, but to go to maybe what helped to make the Art of the Compromise, when they were done in their meeting all together in the convention hall in Philadelphia, when the day was over, oftentimes a lot of those delegates would adjourn to some of the local watering holes, and they would continue their conversations there, and that may have helped spur on some of those compromises in terms of the conversations they had in that other environment.
The socializing that they say used to go on in Washington, that doesn't.
Not only members of their own party, but members of the opposite party, that may have been something to help spur on the types of compromises in legislation that can be more difficult when you don't see that colleague across the aisle as a friend.
Well, let's get to work on the screenplay.
All right.
The book is The United States Constitution and Film, Part of Our National Culture. Eric Casper, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lee has a story that I believe you'll find absorbing just a bit down the road here on Spectrum West. Well, theater companies and venues dot the West Wisconsin landscape, and Jim Oliver knows which ones currently have the lights on each evening.
Thanks, Al. The Phipps Children's Theater will present Willy Wonka Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show will continue weekends through March the 3rd. The River Falls Community Theater will present an evening of one-act comedies Friday and Saturday in Junior's Restaurant and Tap House in River Falls. The Boxcar Children will be staged by the Spring Valley Stagehands Theater February 28th through March the 3rd. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will stage The Cat in the Hat, March the 1st through the 3rd, in the Oxford Theater. The Menominee Theater Guild will stage How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, March the 1st through the 10th. A dinner theater production of Tony and Tina's Wedding will be staged March the 1st and 2nd, and the 8th and the 9th, by the Northern Star Theater in the Rice Lake Elks Lodge. And the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will hold auditions for the musical Mamma Mia, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday evenings in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire.
I am so glad that Jim Oliver contacted his next guest because she brings with her a word we all love to hear. Spring, as in Spring Valley.
The Boxcar Children is a classic children's literary franchise originally created and written in 1924 by Gertrude Chandler Warner, who was a first grade school teacher. Today, the series includes well over 150 titles. The story was adapted for the stage by Minneapolis playwright Barbara Field. She is credited with writing adaptations of other classic stories like The Christmas Carol and Great Expectations. Spring Valley Stagehands Theater will present its production of The Boxcar Children next Thursday and continuing through Sunday, March 3rd in the Stagehands Theater in Spring Valley. Joining us by telephone is the director, Ann Turner. Ann, thanks so much for being with us, and welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this production.
Mm-hmm. The Stagehands Theater, tell us about it. How long has it been around, and how do you go about your business?
The stagehands were started in 1985, starting our 34th year. It was an old movie house. We had a German teacher at the school, Mr. Ken Kratt, and he said, I wonder if we could do a play there. So they built this little stage and started a play, and it's been going ever since.
How many shows a year do you do?
We generally do 4 to 6. There's a traditional concert in there. There's the Follies, which is sort of like a local talent show. We generally do a winter production and then a summer musical. That's sort of our calendar for the year.
How large of an audience will your theater hold?
Our theater holds 220 people.
And I noticed on your webpage that you have a board of directors.
It's got traditional nominations and voting in a person, although this board has been in place for several years now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I served some time on a theater board, and I was really happy to get off, so I admire you folks who are willing to stick with it.
Yeah, we have a great, great president, and everyone on the board really wants to see this theater thrive and continue.
Well, let's get to the play a little bit here. I read the National Education Association called The Boxcar Children one of the top 100 books for children. How do you go about picking your plays?
Generally, a director will come forward and say, this is a play I would like to do. And then the board listens to a synopsis of the story, and generally a budget is submitted. and then they talk about where it would fit in the year. And generally, it's a go. We plug it into the calendar and then go ahead with production.
Uh-huh. Well, tell us what the story is about.
Sure. The Boxcar Children is about four young children, Henry, Jesse, Violet, and Benny. The story starts sadly because they lose their parents and overhear a discussion that they might be separated. They are determined that they're going to stay together, so they run off. And it's their adventures as they travel through Depression-era surroundings and meet different people and figure out how are they going to live. And they run across a boxcar. They settle into that as their home. And then it has a happy ending because they find some family.
We are talking to Ann Turner, who is director of the Spring Valley Stagehands Theater production of The Boxcar Children. Well, it's billed as a children's show, so will it appeal to adults?
Definitely. It's really interesting to watch the storyline and to look back at the nostalgia of the time. And I think a lot of parents have probably read the books themselves or read them to their children. Such a timeless series of books.
Well, why don't you identify the names of the actors?
Henry and Jesse are the twins, and they are played by Kenny Gosgrove, a sixth grader at middle school in Spring Valley. Eva Butts, a fifth grader. Violet is the next younger character. That's Katie Matthias. She's a third grader. And William Webb plays Benny. He's also a third grader at Spring Valley. And then we have a young lady, Shelby Kerg, who has a non-speaking role. It's her first time on stage. She's in fourth grade, so she's finding out a little bit about theater.
Mm-hmm.
We have high schoolers, Abby Graham, a senior at Spring Valley, Emma Eisenbach, a junior at Spring Valley, and then Sam Niebling is also in high school. Then a college student, Mason Johnson, just graduated last year from Spring Valley and is taking college courses. And then our adults are two moms, Alicia Akin and Darice Butts, whose children are in the play, and Carter Turner.
Uh-huh. I'm curious about the set because obviously there's a boxcar in there somewhere. And so how do you go about setting up the stage?
Well, I drew up a plan of what I wanted, and then my husband and I built it. And then we turn it over to our painter, stage painter, Jay Anderson, who works her magic. She does great things, makes everything look wonderful. So she's just finishing her process now. The staging is almost done.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we did build a boxcar.
Okay. Well, that's great. I think everybody would be disappointed if there wasn't a boxcar in there somewhere. Are there set changes? I guess that was my next question. Does it change or does it pretty much stay static?
It's lots of little teeny scenes that just run along. So yes, we have lots of changes. And it could be something as simple as at one time Eva pulls a road sign out with her and then poses with it when the lights come up.
Mm-hmm.
The boxcar originally starts as a little store in a little storefront on a sort of a main street.
Huh.
And it's got the office building and a bakery, and then we call it a mercantile.
Huh.
So the mercantile comes out and it turns and it's the boxcar. The bakery comes out and it turns and it's the junkyard. So it's all these little things that are mobile and quick changing.
Uh-huh. Now, do you have the cast do the set changes, or do you have some people eager to help with?
Yeah, the cast is eager to help. They are the ones moving everything around. Pretty self-contained little cast and crew here.
Sounds good. Now, I'm going to make you tell us about your experience in theater. When did you get started with this this activity, and why do you keep it up?
I have been in it since the beginning,
So
I'm aging myself. But 1985,
mm-hmm.
Ken Kratt had been my high school teacher, and he's the one who said, let's do a show. So he was looking around for interested people, and I jumped right in on that. I stayed with it for a good 15 years or so, and then my kids were grown and in college and busy. So I took a few years off, but I've been back in it now about 10 years and really enjoy directing and all the other things that I like. I like art, and I like building, and I do some graphic advertising, pictures, all of those things.
Oh, that's terrific. Had you been involved in theater before the Stagehands?
No.
Oh, so you were a greenhorn starting out.
Greenhorn starting out,
well,
yeah.
That's terrific. So how do you get tickets for the show?
SVStagehands.org. There's a ticket page. Or they can be purchased at the door also. And the ticket booth will open 1 hour prior to curtain time.
Well, my suggestion to people always is if you're looking for a theater company, just Google the name of the theater, and they'll usually pop up. You can find what you're looking for.
Yes.
Well, the play is The Boxcar Children. It will open next Thursday, February the 28th, and will continue through Sunday, March the 3rd, in the Stagehands Theater in Spring Valley. And we've been talking to the director, Ann Turner. Ann, thanks so much for being with us. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you, Jim. We really appreciate the coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. And thank you guys for visiting Spectrum West this week. Support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Cellist Mark Kosower joins the symphony for its Marching Through March concert Saturday, March 2nd, 7:30 p.m. at the Pablo Center at the Confluence. Tickets at pablocenter.org. Our final story this week is something I call a Vidalia, like the onion. As it's peeled, new layers. At times it makes my eyes water, but in the end, it's just sweet enough. It's about Eric Lee. He's an artist. You're probably familiar with his amazing work, but maybe not his name. His moniker doesn't appear always in conjunction with what you're looking at. That's his humility. Actually, it might be more innate than just modesty. I don't believe he even thinks about himself while he's working. Anyway, this unassuming artisan has been asked, invited, to participate in Europe's most prestigious art event. It's associated with the European Cultural Center, and his invitation came from the Italian version. The event begins in May, and it turns out Eric has things to do between now and then. We're here because we want to declare that he doesn't need to do them all alone. The story begins. I have to tell you, it's good to see you. And I went online over the weekend, had a great time. I browsed the site that touts this event. It's very high-end-ish. Lots of palazzos. I'm using that word a lot today, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
The work that I saw on the website is just utterly amazing. It's where the most daring and innovative people show the world what they've been up to. Tell us how this invitation happened.
Well, you know, it's funny. I got an email. Honestly, I didn't believe it.
there's a lot of scams out there.
Yeah. So actually, I spent the next month trying to discredit it. I was... you know, hopeful, but I didn't really buy it. So I contacted the names that were attached to the email. I also looked up the organization, needless to say. And eventually I ended up writing a lot of the artists who had participated in this in the past. What their thoughts were on this, first and foremost, are these the people you talked with? Is this the same organization? And it took a long time, but many of them got back to me. Yeah, it's the real thing. I still can't believe it, honestly.
You've exhibited in New York and elsewhere, but, I mean, this is international stuff. Are you surprised that they noticed you?
Very surprised, yeah.
Did they explain to you how that happened or not?
Well, I asked. That was part of my wanting to find out if this was real or not, honestly, is, all right, how did you find me? Wanted to hear if they actually knew who I was, first off. And they said they found me online. That was most likely through my posts over the years, my website and the Instagrams and you know all this sort of thing,
sure.
and also probably from my agent in New York at the time doing the same. And she said she found me, this person's name is Svetlana, and she's from Russia, and she said she found me through there. And when I asked why they decided on me, I mean, let's face it, there's many thousands of artists who would just do anything to be a part of this. They meet year-round and decide on who's going to be part of this show.
Okay.
And by the end of it, once they sort of wrapped up the bigger names, and now they're down to these names that they want to include, which are up and coming or new artists, younger artists, or emerging artists, then it gets to be a personal choice on the curator's part. And this Svetlana, I believe, was the one who chose me, found me online and liked what I was doing, and she personally picked me. Apparently, she had been looking for a long time and all sorts of different things, but again, I still consider it like winning the lottery. I don't know how in the world
you know, yeah. all the many
it's wonderful.
People, you know.
You know, if I were to receive an email from somebody named Svetlana, I'd think, okay, they're going to ask me, let's see, who did I vote for last time, and right. am I going to vote next time?
Yeah, look, I had my suspicions, no two ways about it.
Yeah. You know, before I turned on the microphones, you and I were having a conversation, and I was completely unaware of the fact that this news, the timing couldn't have been, I was going to say better, but better is not the best word to use. Well, let's say better for you in your frame of mind, right. because you were coming off of a period in which you did not produce art, and it's completely understandable why. Tell us just briefly what happened to you.
Yeah, our youngest son, Vinny, was diagnosed with brain cancer and had fought that for more than a year. And he finally passed April 2nd of last year, so it was the morning after Easter.
Okay.
Now, during all that time, I hadn't painted, of course, since we got the news. I had no interest in much of anything, needless to say. And then after he passed, I had no interest either.
Yeah.
It's been very difficult. So I didn't really pay any mind to painting, and I certainly didn't post anything about painting. And because I wasn't producing anything, neither did the person I was dealing with in New York, because I had nothing to show.
Sure.
So that made it very, very odd that someone would find me, given that I was basically invisible for 2 years. As you know, if you're on social networking, you got to keep at it, or you don't exist.
I guess it points out the enduring factor of great art. Well, and I'm using the word great. I know you're too humble to use it.
No, I wouldn't. It was strange because it was only, you know, I had finally decided to pick up a painting that I had started before Vinny got sick. Just started it, and not more than a week later, I got that email. And I just couldn't believe it. Yeah, so the timing was, it was, you know, I'll use the word immaculate for my own purposes, because makes no sense to me whatsoever. I'm such a small timer as it is, and then to not have anything done for that long.
I think we should look at Vinny as your new celestial agent.
That's fine with me.
That seems to make sense.
I like that, yeah.
What an amazing story. I'm so glad we're able to talk to you, and I'm so glad that this wonderful thing has happened to you.
Thanks.
Let's talk about the European Cultural Center, devoted to cultural exchanges, meetings, exhibitions, and creative projects. The people that I looked at over the weekend online used words like adventure and risk. So that's, I guess, the kind of people they're looking for, and your artwork must have shown that.
Well, again, I mean, I was surprised. I consider myself pretty conservative compared to the things I've seen over there, honestly. That said, before all this happened in our home, I had started on and finished these three very small, they're miniature works. That was sort of the direction I was headed off to. You know, okay. It was a different direction for me. It was more adventurous as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. But how that would, you know, stack up against things going on out there, I couldn't possibly say. Another funny thing about this is these are tiny paintings I'm sending. They chose the painting. It's a series, or rather it's a triptych, if you want to call it that. It's three individual paintings, and they're each 12 inches square. That's it.
Are they on your website? Because I think I saw three, yeah.
So they're extremely small. For such small things to catch the attention of such an enormous event was another thing that was, I thought, very funny about this.
Did you have a tendency to say, well, these three are good, but you should see this?
I mean,
you have favorites, obviously, and you have ones that are big wow factor things.
Yeah.
I've seen them. You make some big stuff.
I used to anyway. Well, you know, it's funny. Yes, I did. The one that I had just started working on again that I mentioned. Okay, now that one I would really have loved to send over. That's the one that's really, for me, the new direction that I'd like to go in. And it's a direct result of what's happened with my boy and my family. And that would had to have gotten done in time, which I could have done. Mm. But they chose this one, these three. That's actually fine for shipping purposes. So.
Eric Lee in the studio with us. He's an artist. He's also, I'll use the word we coined last time he was here, he's a snarrier. You still building drums or not?
Well, on occasion, yeah.
Okay, on occasion.
Yeah.
He has an amazing affirmation of his work by receiving an invitation to be an exhibitor in the 2019 Venice Biennale. Is that the way you pronounce it?
I guess so.
Yeah, whatever. It's probably one of the world's most prestigious art events, and the exhibit is May through November. The theme is time, space, existence. Is that true? Or is that their cultural center?
Well, it's complicated. I won't pretend to understand all of it myself, but there's two foundations involved. There's the GAA, the Global Arts Affairs Council, I believe, and they are partnered with the ECC, the European Cultural Center, which has, as you mentioned, they have schools, courses, a lot of publications. They work together to put on what you can call satellite shows alongside the official Biennale. They are partnered with the Biennale. Okay, now I'm going to make this distinction. Now, the Biennale itself is for superstars. Okay, these are superstar artists. They're so large that the U.S., they have their pavilion there just as, say, China would, or France or Germany. They each have their own pavilion. It's a long 2-year process of choosing just who they'll send. This is not what I'm in. I'm way too small for that. This is a show that is partnered with the Biennale. The difference being the ECC puts together things for people more along my line. So they'll sponsor a very big name. Like one year they had Yoko Ono there. And then there's names that I personally don't recognize, but these are real big timers. But their whole goal is that people from their countries, backgrounds, economic status and all that, different points in their career. And that's where guys like me come in, I guess.
Yeah, well, you're a superstar.
Yeah, right.
Once you get exhibited at this thing, which isn't an easy thing to do, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. You know, some say draw, others say paint, still others say sculpt as action verbs in what they do artistically. You use the word develop when you talk about your work. It's a long, painstaking process. In fact, I was engrossed in the lengths you go to make something happen. I watched the photographs of you doing the building of those ship ribs.
Oh, yeah.
And gluing them together. And then what do you do with them? You burn them.
Well, of course.
And that supposedly is the sinking of a boat, and then I guess there's flowers coming out of it. It's amazing stuff. I don't know where it comes from, and I could ask you, and you might not be able to explain where it comes from.
No, probably not.
We are all so happy and so proud of you for this distinction, but there is a side to it, because it isn't cheap to get your stuff to exhibit there, like a pizza company trying to get front place in the freezer cabinet.
Right.
So what's involved in that? Have you started like a GoFundMe page? What are you doing? You know, we want to help you.
Well, thanks, first of all. But no, I did not start a GoFundMe page. A lot of the things I probably should do, I'll just be honest with you, it's not in me. I am horrible at fundraising. I've never had the need to fundraise. I've never asked for money.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to start. It's very embarrassing for me. I don't like approaching people. My dad's a salesman. I wish some of that had rubbed off because I'd be more effective. But no, I'm terrible at that, and it costs a lot of money. They don't pay me to go. I pay them. You're right. It's a pay-to-play, and it's exactly what it is.
We're not diminishing it right now by talking about how they operate, but that's the way a lot of big things operate.
Everyone has to pay, no matter what you're doing in one regard or another. We all pay for everything. This is 6 months long in 4 palazzos that they maintain year-round.
I didn't even bring up Venice.
Sorry, in Venice. Yeah. And this is on the Grand Canal. I mean, this is a very expensive place. They have to import everything, you know, all that.
Sure.
All this combines to make it a very expensive event.
Yeah.
Okay. Right now, I can say that thanks to, a very special thanks to Mike Rindo at UWBC.
Okay.
He took time out of his very busy schedule and managed to raise some money for me, which I want to thank him for. Also, I'm talking with Jason John Anderson down at the Pablo, and they're working on things as well. The very good news is because the ECC is a nonprofit and help to write and even give grants, they offered to pay 1/3 of my cost.
Oh, wonderful.
Now, the reason being is because I mentioned before these paintings are so small that a lot of this is based on wall space. How much space are you taking up? Mm-hmm. It's real estate, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these are tiny. And when they reviewed that, they chipped in for 1/3 of what it would cost me overall. So as it stands, I still owe an impossible around $11,000 or $12,000. I still don't know exactly how I'm going to manage this. You know, we'll see what happens. You know, I don't have a lot of time left. They have to have things by mid to late March.
Part of what you did in memory of your son is you disseminated your art in a way that didn't make you any money.
No, I'm a terrible business guy.
You decided to give it away.
I gave all my art away, yeah.
What a wonderful gesture for the people and the places who now have it displayed. We have to make people understand this isn't to get Eric over to Italy and party.
I may not even go. I'm just trying to get the stuff over there. I'm not even banking on going there at all if it saves money.
It'd be nice to have a photograph of you standing there. We should figure out a way to make that happen.
Well, it's when I saw the sticker, I mean, the first time I got this email, I thought, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, I mean, that's more money than I could ever possibly think of spending or trying to raise. I still think that, but I have to try.
Sure.
It's so exceedingly rare to get asked.
Well, you've played a very big role in helping to put Eau Claire on the map over the years artistically, but you have been extremely generous with your time and your artwork, donating both. So we're going to figure this out. I guess what we should say in conclusion, you now know the story. Stay tuned. We'll see what we can do to help one of our own. And hey, congratulations most of all on the distinction. It's well deserved. And you'll just go, oh gosh, you know, because that's how you are. But it is. Good luck.
Thanks a lot, Al.
Now, I got to dive in here and tell you that when we were talking about Eric giving away his art, it was to places like the Pablo Center to display and sell. But here's something astounding. The selling price, determined by the buyer, all of it, at Eric's request, goes to Beacon House, the shelter that provides a place for families and individuals when no other place exists. Huh? Wow. I'm happy to report, since our conversation, artists and gallery owners Joellen Burke and Terry Meyer have started a GoFundMe page. You can go to the GoFundMe page. You can click search, enter support for Eric Lee. You might put a dash between each of those words. It'll get you there quicker. The page will open. You can click it to make it bigger and then do what comes naturally after that. What do you say? Nick Meyer and the folks at Volume 1 have been expounding on what we've talked about here. I believe it'll be posted online yet today and appear in the next printed Volume 1 issue. So that's pretty cool stuff. And lots of people have received emails as well. To everyone who has listened and taken this to heart, thanks, and let's just see where this road leads. Coming up next week on Spectrum West, lots of music. Vicki Emerson has a new album, and We Banjo 3 will be in Eau Claire soon. And there will be more, because there's always more on Spectrum West. Thanks, Erica, Dean, and Kate for backstage stuff. And thank you guys for being the audience that we've grown so close to. It's starting to feel like a family, for gosh sakes. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. We'll do it again next week. Hope you're here. Bye.